Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. This is Aaron Erber, your host, and today I'll be discussing, this has kind of been a long time in the making. We've been trying to plan this for over a month now, and we finally got it, and we're going to be talking about a new book today that came out, I believe, in 2023 in August, I think that's right, and it's from Sophia Institute Press, and it's called Guadalupe and the Flower World Prophecy, How God Prepared the Americas for Conversion Before the Lady Appeared. And I have the authors here, and we're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about the Aztec sort of mythology and the sort of prophecy that the Mesoamerican people believed in that was fulfilled in Our Lady of Guadalupe. So welcome, Joseph and Monique Gonzalez. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. We're really happy to be here.
Yeah, and you guys have been doing a lot of interviews and stuff, and so hopefully this will be interesting for you guys too, for more of a mythological sort of focus, because this whole podcast is largely it kind of started off as science fiction and fantasy as kind of my focus, so highlighting different Catholic or Orthodox or generally Christian authors who write in the science fiction and fantasy genre that don't get a lot of attention. So I kind of started it that way, and then it kind of turned into fairy tales and mythology. It kind of blossomed into this whole thing with mythology and fairy tales, because I couldn't not talk about those things, because so many authors pull from those. So I had to start learning about them more in depth. And go ahead and just kind of introduce yourselves, and just how you came to know Our Lady of Guadalupe.
My name is Joseph Gonzalez, and I'm Mexican-American, so, you know, being Mexican-American, you know, Guadalupe is everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, you see images of her in every bakery and every auto shop. And I went to Our Lady of Guadalupe Elementary School, and Guadalupe is everywhere. You know, even my grandma's name is Guadalupe. So that's how I came to know her. I'm also a composer, and I worked in Hollywood scoring the underscore for many different motion pictures and TV shows and things like that. But I also did classical music. And back in the early 1990s, I wanted to write a symphonic choral piece that would use Aztec song poetry. And that's actually part of the story. We can go into that later. But that's when I discovered this Aztec song poem that sounds almost identical to the Guadalupe story. And of course, you know, scholars said, well, this earlier song poem is obviously the basis for a fabricated, that is made up, Guadalupe story, and it really hurt my faith. So that's a little bit about myself and my relationship to Guadalupe, and I'm sure we're going to get into it more later, but here's my wife, Monique.
Hi, I'm Monique Gonzalez, and I'm from a suburb to the west of LA, pretty close to Malibu. Grew up out there, started studying classical voice. I am a convert, more or less. I wasn't raised with faith at all, except transcendental meditation and Buddhism and that type of thing. So it's more that background. But when I had my conversion, I had a hard time with Mary, and there's a long story behind that. But I credit my concentration on her to Penny Lord. I don't know if any of your listeners know who she is, but she was a very popular evangelist in the 80s and 90s. And I knew her grandson, and she pulled me into her room, and she said, you know, I really believe that Jesus is calling you to get to know his mother. You need to concentrate on her. She handed me a book on Our Lady and said, you need to get to know her, behold thy mother, and you just need to concentrate on that. So it was an intellectual exercise for me for many, many years until 2006. And then I had some longstanding issues that I really struggled with, that I was constantly going to God with and saying, I need help with these things, and why aren't you helping me? And in 2006, he sent me Our Lady of Guadalupe. who revealed herself, let's say, and a massive healing occurred. And so I committed myself to her because of that, because the issues were one day there and the next day completely gone. And these were things that had been in my life for like 30 years or something like that. So I, 2006, that happened. Then I met Joseph 3 years later. He showed me this ancient song poem, and it occurred to me, now I think I am beginning to understand why she healed me of these in transit issues. And I was like, okay, well, wherever this is going to go, I'll follow it as far as we're supposed to take it.
Yeah, I thought, because in the introduction, you guys both kind of relate your kind of experience with discovering that ancient song poem. And Joseph, you're kind of scandalized by that, right? By the scholarly interpretation that it's that the Our Lady, that the Nikan Mapahua is the poem that relates the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe, that was a fabrication because it was based so closely, or it was, you know, it was so close to, in terms of theme and structure, to the one of the original song poems. And Monique, you're since you're a convert, your response was very interesting because you're just like, well, that's a challenge. Let's figure this out, you know. And I thought that was a very unique sort of approach. And because I'm kind of I'm a revert, so I kind of grew up Catholic, fell away, and now I'm back. Like I was telling you both before we started, Our Lady of Guadalupe is very dear to my heart because we've been very devoted to her for a long time, because she's the patroness of the Americas too. So my daughter was also born on the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So she's, you know, that feast day is very, very important to our family. And so I had another episode on Our Lady of Guadalupe last year, 2 years ago. I can't remember now. But it was with Lydia Lay. And we talked about the sort of the bloodier aspects of the Aztec religion and how the tilma, we focus a lot on the tilma and how the symbolism of the tilma kind of corresponded in some ways to both the Spanish and the native peoples, and how they both kind of, it was like the synthesis of both of those sets of like symbolism, I guess. And so this episode is kind of putting Our Lady in context with the Mesoamerican kind of culture that this happened in. And this book is kind of groundbreaking. And I've been very, very interested in how paganism, the pagan stories like point to Christ in imperfect ways, right? But they do. And I think more and more people are kind of cluing in on that. So like, I think one of the examples you gave in the book is Yggdrasil, the world tree in Norse mythology, how that's, you know, very, it's a lot of it is kind of complicated because like we only know those stories from Christians, right? They're transcribing it and copying it down, but they're, that whole story is very reminiscent of the Christian narrative. But this one is, I think, groundbreaking because you actually found like direct evidence, you know? So let's go into that. So the song poem, what was the story behind the song poem that you found? What was it called? And kind of what was the story that was in that song poem?
Quick of a Child.
Okay, well, just to give a little bit of background, there's about 180 known Aztec song poems that were collected after the fall of the Aztec Empire. That would have been in the 16th century. And 90 of them are contained in one volume called the Cantares Mexicanos, which would have referred to the Mexica, who are also known as the Aztecs. But also it kind of applies to all the various people of that area, kind of the central Mexico, Mesoamerica, Valley of Mexico, who were known as the Nahua. And they were the Nahua because they all spoke Nahuatl, the language, a common language. Well, they not only shared language, but they also shared kind of a similar tradition of writing. A subgenre of these song poems were called flower song poems. And we can get into that, why they were called that. It was a connection between beauty and truth and this otherworldly place known as the flower paradise. Well, anyway, the very first song that was collected is called the Cuica Pecayoc, or the origin of the songs. And this song poem is, a flower song poem, is really interesting because it lays out a narrative about a singer who's looking for flowers. Well, we know that the flowers are a metaphor for ultimate beauty, ultimate truth. So the singer's looking for the truth of the universe. What is truth? And he's going around and he's asking these butterflies and he's asking these beautiful hummingbirds. He's saying, where are these beautiful flowers? I got to find these flowers. And he actually says, if I find those flowers, I will gather them in my tilma and I will show those flowers to the lords and princes. Okay. So it's very kind of reminiscent. It has the same structure of the hero story. Okay. So, So anyway, what happens is that the singer is looking for the flowers and the hummingbird says, you know what? I'm going to show you, singer, where I'm going to lead you to the flower world paradise. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to show you. And so the story continues on. The hummingbird leads him into the flower world paradise where he seemingly finds the flowers, gathers his in his tilma, shows them to the lords and princes, and they all rejoice, and they're so happy that they found these flowers and that he's in this flower world paradise, and they give homage to the god of far and near, otherwise known as Intlokken Nawake. Now, what's really strange about this story is on the last two verses of this poem, we find out that the singer actually didn't go to the flower world paradise. He actually didn't find the flowers. And he laments, he cries out, and he says, I got this glimpse of this other world. And, you know, it's so, you know, I want to find these flowers, but I couldn't find them. And he even gives the reason. He says, I couldn't find them because I'm afflicted. I'm worthless. I sin on earth. And right at the very end, he says, you know what? Only the God of far and near can make us worthy to enter the flower world paradise. So what a strange way to end this song poem. So when you stand back, you actually say, wait a minute, this has the structure of the hero's journey, the monomyth that we can talk about a little bit later, but also it's a failed hero story because our hero, the singer, never found the flowers, the truth. Ultimate truth, ultimate beauty. He never did actually enter the flower world paradise. So it's a failed hero story.
Quest.
He never filled the quest. It's a paradise lost story also. So as we state in the book, a paradise lost story, a failed hero story, it cries out for a hero who's eventually going to find the flowers, who's eventually going to enter the flower world paradise, and somebody who's going to fulfill the quest.
Yeah. And so that's situated, the last two lines are very powerful because everything kind of just falls apart, right? Everything falls apart and he realizes that he actually has not found the truth that he's looking for. This wasn't in one of my questions, but it just kind of occurred to me now, but like what sort of psychological response would that produce in their culture, right? Like if that was like they almost got it, but then they failed. So how would that affect their culture at large? And this is another question I had too. How is this story and these songs, the Flower World Paradise and all these song poems, how is that kind of tied into the Aztec? I know the Aztecs were just one of the peoples there. But the hummingbird god of blood and war, you know, like all the human sacrifice, how are those all tied together?
Well, to address the first question, you know, we've been reading a lot of Jordan Peterson.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, what is the purpose of story? What is the purpose of myth? And we really agree with the sentiment that myths are what drive a culture's or a people's identity of who and what they are, right? So what do you do when you have a myth where you never are able to fulfill your fundamental quest, your fundamental orientation and purpose of life, you never attain it? It kind of stands to reason then that you're going to be thinking of yourselves as victims, people who are constantly under the hand of fate. And it changes your orientation towards the world. It changes the way you act. It changes the choices that you make, the governance, everything. It's just you're acting as a failed hero who's always fighting against something that you can never overcome, that you can never, you know, orient yourself properly. You're always struggling. It's always going to be a pain. Mm-hmm. And so you see that. It kind of makes sense if you see how things were right before the Spanish arrived. It was very much kind of like the natural end of that type of mentality, I guess you could say. Yeah. So I'm sure Joseph would like to jump in and say more.
Yeah, because, you know, when kind of your primary archetype upon which you base your identity, your individual identity, and even as a culture, is essentially a failed hero. Perhaps the best way to understand this is through Jesus Christ, who is the victorious hero. You're going to see yourself differently. You're going to see yourself as a people who've already conquered death, mm-hmm. and who, if you are baptized, and if you live in a state of grace, you should be able to go to the flower world paradise, which of course Juan Diego was when he actually entered into the flower world paradise, as we see in the Nikon Mopoa or the account of Guadalupe. So, you know, I love this subject so much, and I'm so happy that you're into myth, I just love this because, you know, if you look at Dionysus or Osiris, yeah. and you have the myth of dismemberment or death and then resurrection, mm-hmm. you're seeing a pattern of reality that's throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And of course, and I'm sure we're going to go into true myth, you know, a la C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, but it sets a pattern of reality which needs to be fulfilled. And in this case, of course, all myths point to the true myth of Jesus Christ, who is victorious over death. So it ties into your question because it changes the way we see ourselves, or people would see themselves as victorious.
Which enables you to make different choices.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's with a failed quest mythos, like Orpheus too. Orpheus is similar, where he fails, you know, but through an act of disobedience, basically, where it'll produce this sort of hopelessness and despair in your culture,
yes.
you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. that's another one. You know, the so many of these story structures, even like Oedipus or any yeah. scenes of a failed hero, the is that, you know, the character is not all that bad.
Right.
You actually can kind of identify with this hero, but they always have some sort of flaws to them.
A fatal flaw that
does not get, and you find the exact same thing in this Cuicapecayot of Mesoamerica.
So with this this failed hero's quest, you know, would the massive sacrifices, like human sacrifice, would that be a way to like make up for that? Is that kind of how you would describe that? Like if they're going, we're not worthy to be in the flower world paradise, so we have to, you know, I don't know, appease the blood god, you know, by sacrificing so many people a year. Are those two tied together then? They're trying to like make themselves worthy in the blood of others or something? These are just things I'm trying to reconcile with, because it's such a beautiful story. And with the rest of Aztec, maybe not the rest of Aztec mythology or you know, Mesoamerican mythology, it's violent. It's like with every pagan, you know, I don't want to say belief system, but because it varied, but you have these beautiful shiny moments, right? And then you have like blood and death.
well, that's why, you know, we really had to go into the history
yeah.
of things because, you know, unfortunately, you know, including ourselves, you know, we didn't really know much about Mesoamerican
right.
history, you know.
Right.
Most people think of, you know, Apocalypto or,
right. yeah.
think of, you know, it was all Aztecs and all human sacrifice, you know, all the time.
Right, which wasn't not true. Yeah, right.
Which was not true. You know, there were many different groups and, mm-hmm. and they had many different beliefs. So the way that we explain in our book is that the, you know, the flower world concepts, which included these flower song poems, and also which we find in archaeological ruins of the four-petaled flower and this desire to go to the flower world paradise, which I'm sure we'll get into later, was basically kind of the foundational myth of Mesoamerica, we believe, and other scholars think the same way. So the thing is, though, is that what creeps in, though, is this idea of elite manipulation. See from the very, where you actually see rulers or leaders that are gatekeepers. They're actually shown at the entrance of caves or entrance to this flower world paradise. And we think that probably as we enter into the Nahua period in the 15th century, we see this thing called the flower wars. Mm-hmm. Now, which is actually when human sacrifice really, really started.
And yeah.
really, there was a huge uptick. This is around the 1450s. And what happens is that one of the leaders, one of the Aztec leaders of the Mexica, actually said, well, because of this, they were suffering drought and famine at the time, we must appease the gods, and we must do that by continual war that didn't even make any sense, because usually there were other kind of reasons why an empire would go to war with its neighbor or something, but these wars were primarily to acquire sacrificial victims, and by the thousands, by the hundreds of thousands, and it was meant to it was involved in this whole idea of Flower World, that if you were a warrior, or if you were even a sacrificial warrior or victim, by spilling blood, you would go to the Flower of Paradise. You would turn into a butterfly or a hummingbird, and you would go up to heaven or the Flower of Paradise. So these concepts, as you were saying, that are really kind of beautiful and express so beautifully in these flower song poems, in reality, they became very bloody, very horrible. I mean, just the atrocities that were committed by the so-called Aztecs.
And it coexists, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So we had to explain that the second in command of the second most powerful group, known as the Alcoa, also known as the Texcocans, because they ruled out of the city of Texcoco, they really tried to retain the flower song poem tradition. And many of the flower songs that we see from the 1400s came from the Alcoa people, and especially King Nezahualcóyotl, who was their ruler.
Hungry Coyote, is that right?
Hungry Coyote, yes, absolutely. Right. So it's a way to be able to, we had to go into it because we had to show people, you know, it wasn't just all Aztecs all the time.
Yeah, right.
And how these things could exist. And I don't know if Monique had anything to add to that.
Well, just while that is all true, we're still getting back to a fundamental idea of blood atonement, which is a reality in pagan cultures, because they haven't, there's an understanding of there's a barrier to heaven, right?
Right.
Whatever you want to call it, there's a barrier. And this exists in the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. The way it resolves in the Judeo-Christian tradition is that the Jews would, and many other cultures would, sacrifice animals as atonement for this barrier. But then Jesus Christ becomes the ultimate sacrifice, so it no longer needs to be done. And this hadn't happened yet here in the Americas. Right. So they're simply reflecting something that's understood by all cultures and all people, that there needs to be something to make amends, so to speak, for that barrier, or to tear down that barrier. So while it was amped up to an obscene degree in that past century, it's still hinging on a fundamental concept that we as Catholics accept, that Christ is merciful, but there is a justice that needs to be resolved, that he is the resolution for that, but it still needs to be attained. Yeah. Maybe sometimes we forget that. So what we're just seeing, it, we're seeing it in stark relief in the Nahua right before the Spanish occur. But it's as brutal and atrocious that it is, paganism is brutal. It is atrocious because of that, because of the nature of that. So that's all I have to say.
And then, so you have Hungry Coyote, who is kind of this poet king, who was more or less monotheistic, if I understand. He wanted to worship the god of the far and near. And then explain how Snake Woman kind of comes in and starts throwing a wrench into things, and in propagandizing, you know, propagandizing the flower songs, and how so Snake Woman was actually a man. So explain that. He fascinates me to no end. But both Hungry Coyote and Snake Woman are extremely fascinating to me. So go ahead and explain that that character.
So Snake Woman or Woman Snake. He was actually the half brother of one of the first emperors of the Mexica.
The
Aztecs, as everybody else calls them. And he ruled for approximately five different emperorships.
Okay.
So he's considered the right-hand guy who's advising all of these emperors on how to do things.
He's the epitome of the evil advisor. He's like, you know, in like every Disney movie ever. Like, you know, you have the evil advisor to the king. You know, that's him.
He's perfect.
He's Rasputin.
Yeah, exactly.
In spades. So this guy comes in, and, you know, we could speculate on what made him so clever, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But for him to enter in and be whispering into the emperor's ear and saying, you know, I think it's because he was the head of the armies.
Right.
But by virtue of his office, and he's basically saying he's one who came up with this idea
of the flower.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we find in some of the accounts where he's advising everybody, OK, this is what's happening. The gods are upset. That's why we're not getting any food, because they had like 3 years of granaries and it got completely depleted. So people are starving. And he's like, okay, the resolution to this is we just have to start sacrificing a lot of people. And initially, it's really horrible. Yes. Initially, Nezahual Coyote is depicted as Hungry Coyote comes in and says, well, I don't know if I necessarily agree with this, but he got overruled and outvoted by the other leaders, who then said, no, let's go with Lakalalsang. Let's try this out. See if this works. So it started. The flower wars start at that point. It's 1453.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting is that, you know, the Aztecs, you know, they were under the rule of a previous empire known as the Tepanac Empire. So the Aztec Empire, or the Triple Alliance, because that started in 1427, 1428 or so. Mm-hmm. And the Tlacala was very, very shrewd. So
he was the instigator of that alliance, as a matter of fact.
Right. Okay. They would have never been able to overthrow the previous Tepanac Empire unless they did what he said. And what he did is that he instigated very, very marriages with very different different groups. So
with the oldest groups in the area, actually.
Yeah, the other powerful groups, so that by marriage they had this alliance. Mm. And not only that, at the same time, you know, the Tenochtitlan, the place where they were, you know, located, it was in the middle of a lake. So
this was not a common thing back then.
Yeah, they were in the middle of a lake. So through kind of you know, building and kind of packing in mud, or, you know, these massive kind of building projects, at the same time they were literally expanding their landmass, at the same time they were expanding their political influence. So Snake Woman was super, super important to this. And you know, his influence was felt all the way to the beginning, when the Spanish arrived in 1519, even though he had been dead for a few years.
Right. And just a quick little tidbit, another thing that he was very instrumental in doing was he was well known for erasing the history of his people.
Right.
So Nezahual Coyote writes a whole poem saying Tlacalao's really off the chains. He's destroying the books. He's burning them. He's creating this whole new mythology. You know, the whole idea that he can't be trusted, because he's, if you're going to do away with the history, you certainly can't trust him with the present or the future.
Right.
So there's that antipathy, even though there was an alliance.
And why was he named Snake Woman? Why did he take that title?
That's the official name that they gave to the advisor. We don't really know where the origin is.
But... Well, it was an office. It was actually kind of like the name of a high priest.
Didn't he bring in worship of the serpentine fertility goddess? Isn't that what he emphasized? Like they should be worshiping. I thought I read that in your book. Like that instead of like the god of the far and near, he's like, we should be worshiping the snake goddess, who is the goddess of war and fertility. And if we kill more people, we become more fertile, you know?
we didn't go into this in the book, but what he basically did was the Mexica people, he completely changed their mythology.
Yeah.
They had been previously, like most of the other Nahua groups, that were more focused on the benevolent god of Quetzalcoatl, meaning the feathered serpent, but what he did, and that was their primary god, so to speak.
Right.
But what he did is that he switched it to Huitzilopochtli, which is the hummingbird of war.
Okay. I got that mixed up. Yep.
Yeah, so he made that their primary god, because he believed, in the mythology, he said that they were a warring people that were meant to subjugate all the people in the area. So so that's why on the temple of it was dedicated to Huitzilopochtli, which was finished in 1487.
Okay.
And when that festival occurred, there were estimates up to what I think 80,000 people were sacrificed in a three-day period.
Wow.
Yes.
That is so much. It's crazy. I can't even fathom what that, like, just even the logistics of it. Like, how would you even do that? It's crazy. So going back to, let's go back to the flower world. So could you describe, so it's there's a couple different things that kind of go along with it, and flowers are related to divine truth. Could you explain that and explain? The quincunx and the quatrefoil. Could you explain that and how they relate to the world axis or the axis mundi?
Yeah, sure. In order to understand these symbols of the quincunx and the quatrefoil, you first have to understand the axis mundi. Mm-hmm. So the axis mundi, the concept behind that is basically you would have four directions of the known universe, which would be north, south, east, and west. But you would have a vertical point, and this vertical point would go in two directions. It would go down into the underworld, known as Mikshlan. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. But it also would go vertically up to the flower world paradise. Okay. So it was a 3D model of this kind of extra dimensional kind of universe, right? So this was portrayed as a kind of like when you look at the dice, the five mm-hmm. on a dice where you would have the four with the point in the middle. That's one of the ways that it was symbolically portrayed, because you would have the four outer dots, which mean north, south, east, and west. But the center point would be the vertical axis. If you kind of like saw through the point, it would pass through into this other realm known as the flower world paradise. So what happened is that you begin to see a flower, a four-petaled flower that is superimposed over this symbol. And basically what it meant is that through beauty, you can reach ultimate beauty in this other place. In this other place is where kind of it's very Plato-ish, Platonic, mm-hmm. because Plato said that on Earth we can reach ultimate beauty by seeing beauty here on Earth. But the ultimate perfection of a perfect flower, for example, or something that we see, is we only know it in comparison to this perfect form which exists somewhere else. So it gets into the idea of transcendence, of beauty, truth, and goodness. But we, you know, we might want to add here that it wasn't just visual beauty through the flower. It involves so many other things, especially music. Mm-hmm. So music that we would experience here on Earth can give us a glimpse of heavenly music. So once we start getting into the flower song poems, you're going to see that flowers and songs are used interchangeably. You're going to see where the singer is calling down the flowers from heaven so we can sing flowers. So that's essentially the four-petal flower, the axis mundi, everything else that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool is like very much an understatement. that's pretty neat, you know. It's another thing you pointed out in your book related to the axis mundi is the flower world is usually depicted in a mountain, like in a mountain or on top of a mountain, you know, it kind of varied. But and then when you have an opening into a cave, it'd be the flower would kind of take the shape of a monster's face. And that reminded me a lot of, I don't know if you know, like Eastern, Christian iconography, where you have like the hell mouth, you know, where it's Satan's mouth that people are, and now this is a different thing because it's, you know, the flower world is a paradise, but it struck me as very reminiscent of that, where you have to like go through this monster to reach the other side. And so I don't know if you knew that, also that paradise in the Christian context is also traditionally it's depicted as a mountain. And you don't get that in Genesis, but you get it in,
Revelation.
Isaiah. I think Isaiah too. Like he's, you know, talking about mountain. I think the, but paradise is usually depicted on the top of a mountain. So I love that kind of stuff in these pagan mythology, and you know, and then I obviously have like Olympus, and you have you know, the different mountains in the Old Testament that you'd go and meet, you know, different pagan deities and have, you know, all these things. But I guess I didn't have a question specifically.
It's It's an interesting observation because I started doing more research, and yeah, there's a constant symbolism of caves inside of mountains, mm-hmm. both on the Judeo side as well as the Christian side. I mean, you see with the church fathers and yeah. the Carmelites, you know, it's a priest going into caves mm-hmm. inside of mountains and they're praying to God, and you see it all throughout Revelation. So it's kind of interesting to think about in those terms. But Joseph and I were talking about it earlier and kind of going into, you know, taking that model and kind of expanding upon it, if you want to
yeah.
jump in.
Yeah, what's happening and what you're seeing on pottery shards and different kind of reliefs through Mesoamerica is the idea that a square has four points with the center point, which where you would kind of go through, where you would have a passage, just like what I was explaining before. Mm-hmm. Now, what you see on some of these pottery shards all the way back to the Olmec period, which is the earliest civilization of the Americas, is you see a square that's adorned with flowers, okay? So anthropologists, archaeologists say, okay, we're talking about the Axis Mundi here, okay? Mm-hmm. But the square is actually shaped as the maw or the mouth of a ferocious animal.
Yeah.
Okay? So they're trying to, and especially at this place called Chalcancinco, where there is a cave, where there is actually a depiction of a passageway that you would have to go through in order to symbolizing death and the afterlife, is that what is happening is that the way that scholars seem to understand it now is that going through a cave is a passageway into death, mm-hmm. but it's also a passageway to the flower world paradise.
Potentially.
Okay. So now when you go through this tunnel to the center of a mountain, which also is the center of a pyramid too,
in
just a second, is that it actually, the passageway will actually lead to a place that has four chambers to it. That's actually shaped itself as a four-petaled flower. Mm. So the idea here is that within a mountain, through death, you can reach potentially the flower world paradise. So, of course, if you look at the overall model of it, it's not just pointing up to paradise, it's also pointing down to the dreary underworld of Mishlan. Right. Okay. But.
And the flower acts as a filter, so to speak, which we can get into in a
like
little bit.
Yeah, like a filter, yeah. like a portal.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
So the reason why these ideas are becoming so important, because just within the last 20 years, they found shafts under the pyramids, which are right outside of Mexico City, called Teotihuacan. And these shafts under specifically the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Plumed Serpent, also known as the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpent, mm-hmm. or the Pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, has many different names and references, is recently they found these tunnels underneath the pyramids. And what do they lead to? What happens under the center point of these pyramids? Well, it breaks into a four chamber, a four petaled or four lobed chamber, so to speak. So the only way that they can explain is saying, this must be a depiction of people transferring through a tunnel through death, going to the center point, and the center point of this pyramid or structure is a portal up to the flower world paradise. So the whole pyramid itself is a 3D model. It's of the Axis Mundi and the desire to want to go to the flower world paradise. So lots of symbol here. In fact, they've even given it a name. They call it Flower Mountain.
Yeah. So the whole structure is a model of that flower world paradise. It's like all symbolically kind of linked together. It's amazing. It's really amazing because I wonder. This is another thing that's coming to mind. Like our churches, like Catholic churches, traditionally were built kind of similar, right? You have the usually it's a dome on top of a square, right? And so you have like the four corners of the earth, and you have the dome, which is like the heavens, and it's supposed to be this symbolic, you know, model of the cosmos, right? And so. And I'm just thinking like, okay, well, that's obviously something that pagan peoples did like all the time. And like everyone, like whenever they're attuned to something transcendental, they want to build their buildings, at least their religious buildings off of, you know, as a model for that, for their cosmic understanding. So yeah, it's just amazing. And this is all just being discovered in the last like 20 years. And so,
if I could just kind of riff off that idea, you know, there was this article that I was just reading the other day. I think it was Eric Weinstein. Mm. And he was talking about the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. And he said that, you know, he called it a portal. What did he call it? A portal to heaven or something. Yeah. And somebody wrote an article about it, and they were showing pictures, and they showed that, you know, when you have the altar, you know, of this Catholic church, and if you look up, you see this beauty. I'm not quite sure what the structure is. Maybe it's some sort of a dome or something. And, mm-hmm. and you're seeing pictures, and it's just beautiful. And they were describing it as a portal to heaven. So yeah. It has very much this kind of similar structure that you were talking about.
Right.
And just to jump off of that, Joseph and I have talked a lot about the nature of the church, you know, as mm-hmm. a model of paradise, which maybe we tend to forget about because right. we get so used to going to these churches. But
right.
initially, especially if you see it in a high Gothic, you know, you have mm-hmm. these structures that are pointing straight up, and you have the stained glass with light filtering through them,
right.
you know, creating that kind of sense of radiance, you know, permeating you. And then it has all the intense incense, the aromas, every sense is captivated.
Right.
Whether
exactly.
it's through your touch or with the music,
the choir.
It's incredible. This polyphony that when you combine all of these elements together, this is the Catholic Church trying to recreate
right.
paradise
right.
for 1 hour, literally. So you can experience heaven. And it was, you know, this it spurs a lot of fun conversations for Joseph and I. Like,
I bet.
A lot of this,
yeah.
You know, and it'd be nice to maybe reinvigorate that in today's day and age.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. When we participate in the liturgy, it's like we are entering into paradise at that moment, you know. And with these recent discoveries of these ancient temples, they're after the same thing. They wanted the same thing, right? So why don't we talk about now, so we had the Christians come, right, the Spanish, and they are not very successful right away at all, really, with a few exceptions, kind of evangelizing. So why don't we talk about why their approach, like, why didn't it work? Like, let's start with that.
I think it comes down to a simple answer. It's just pure misunderstanding of the culture they were walking into. I mean, people, you know, it had been many, many years since Christians had attempted to evangelize outside of a set geographical area. So I think it's just an issue of experience and practice. And maybe forgetting how much that one needs to learn and understand about a culture before trying to evangelize them. And in this particular case, these weren't a simple people. These were established civilizations going back thousands of years. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the Olmecs and the Mayans were talking 1500 BC, 1200 BC. They're known for having trade networks spanning thousands of miles, and they're supporting hundreds of thousands of people. These aren't hunter-gatherer.
Right.
Groups. These are deeply entrenched governmental with intricate, complex religious beliefs. So it stands to reason that those intricate, complex beliefs would be completely unknown to mm-hmm. the Spanish. I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, we haven't gotten into it yet. You know, is that basically the way we explain in our book is that a lot of these concepts, especially the flower, mm-hmm. which we talked about in the Flower World Paradise, these carry over into the Nahuatl period and form this, what people call it Nahuatl philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a whole philosophy that they based their life, that they based their society on, as we talked about misinterpretations of it, which would have been the flower, you know, what we talked about, Snake Woman. But essentially, it was deeply ingrained in them. And, you know, we were talking to some friends of ours, very, you know, learned individuals, and we thought, you know, we know more about Nahuatl now than the Franciscans knew 500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we were saying, these flower song poems were not translated until about 50 years ago.
Really, it's in their entirety.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah,
the full translation didn't happen until 1985 of these flower song poems. The whole idea of Nahuatl philosophy really started in the mid-1950s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's been discussed and people have written books and papers on it since then. So, and of course, we talked about the archaeology and things like that. So we know more about them then. So the reason why this is important, because think about a Franciscan who's newly arrived, and he's just barely trying to understand the language,
let alone the metaphors.
Yeah, which is so metaphorical, which is so symbolic. And as the Franciscans come to understand after a few decades of this, is they realize we don't know these people at all. We can barely translate their flower symbols. They seem like nonsense to us.
They're saying it's incomprehensible and beyond understanding, so you can't blame them.
Right.
Right. So you feel bad for the Franciscans. They're given like this almost impossible task, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, what they were seeing with the human sacrifice, it was right for them to assume, okay, this is a polytheistic, very simple kind of culture.
Right.
And we must go in there to try to persuade them. Well, as we can see in the way we explain in the book, is that you have this firmly entrenched pagan idea about a transcendent reality and different things. And then you have this Christian concept of the exact, in a way, similar things. They were actually had plenty of meeting points that could happen, but they couldn't see it, and we can't blame them. But that's why the Guadalupe story is so important, because it bridges those concepts. And I'm sure we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
So that's a primary reason why they failed. It was miscommunication. They didn't know the culture and language.
Well, as I was reading that section, I just was like, oh, come on. You know, this is not how you evangelize people. You know, this is not how you do that. Like how did you do it before with the Germanic peoples and like all that stuff? And it's like, you know, Monique, to your point, it's like it's been hundreds of years since they've had to evangelize a whole group of people. It's been a very long time. And so they don't, it's like the skills that, you know, previous Christians had in evangelizing pagans, other than just being martyred, you know, a lot of it's lost. And a lot of their approach to it was very like, okay, well, you're doing all these bad things, you need to stop. And they're like, well, all of these things, why? They're tied to our wealth, they're tied to our culture. Like, I don't want to stop having multiple wives. Like, I'm rich, you know? And which is another interesting point too. I never thought about polygamy as like increasing your wealth because you have more people to like, you know, work your property and, you know, and all that stuff. I never considered it that way. This is they kind of were failing, but they didn't quite fail, right? They didn't quite fail. They had a few converts, and Juan Diego was one of them. Which is a testament to Juan Diego's faith, you know, just because it's like, okay, well, you converted with their very bad arguments and you were convinced. So like, there's something special about you, Juan Diego. So why don't we talk about that? So how does Our Lady of Guadalupe within the course of a year, you go from no baptisms to thousands and thousands and thousands of baptisms to the point where they need more priests, they need more people, and people are walking hundreds of miles and like confessing their sins and saying, okay, I'm sticking with my first wife, I got rid of the other ones, you know, and I'm getting rid of our slaves, not going to sacrifice to the gods anymore. So how do we get there?
Well, to start, okay, I was going to say the Guadalupe story. Let's dive into the Guadalupe story.
Yeah.
This is where the indicators all begin. So it happened, this is 10 years after the fall of the Aztec or Mexica Empire, and we have this baptized Christian who's walking to Mass, approximately 14 miles, and everything's the ordinary world, right? But then he passes by the hill of Tepeyac, and he's just all of a sudden swept into this paradisal realm.
Yeah,
it's not an earthly realm. Everything's glowing and emitting light and rainbows. Sparkling, it's singing, the entire environment is singing, it's the sound of precious birds, and the songs are echoing off of each other, the flowers and the rocks are singing to one another. It's completely otherworldly place, and it shocks him so intensely that we find him saying, am I worthy of what I hear? Could I be in the place my ancient ancestors spoke of, the flower world paradise in the land of heaven? But the way he says it in his native language, it's a particular phrase. And I don't know if I need to say it, but it's in Xochitlalpan and Tonacatlalpan. I don't expect anybody to remember it, but it's a hard one. But what it means, it's loaded. It's completely loaded. And it's directly tied to this ancient song poem, which is a full description of this place. And it's considered millions of years old. I mean, thousands of years old, potentially. It's ancient, millions of years old. It's considered very ancient, and it would have been understood by the entirety of the people of Mesoamerica what that place was. Mm-hmm. Do you want to jump from there?
Right. I mean, this place, there's been full-on analysis of this phrase, which we're not doing it justice by calling it the Flower World Paradise. Uh-huh. It's actually two different concepts that are tied together.
Yeah.
It's the Flower World Paradise, the place of ultimate beauty, the place of ultimate music and beauty and music. It radiates just beauty, but it's also the second phrase is called Tonacatlalpan, which essentially means a place of sustenance, but it's also the place of creativity.
Origin.
So the origin of people, the origin of beauty, the origin of everything. So for Juan Diego to actually say this phrase is so amazing, because he says, could I be in, and he uses that phrase, which we say the Flower of Paradise. He says, am I worthy to be in this place? And then he says, could this be the place our ancient ancestors spoke of? So why in the world would he say that unless he already knew about this place?
Yeah, right.
And obviously, if he's talking about his ancient ancestors, it must be part of his culture. So the reason why there's this seamless segue from the earlier song poem, which, as you know, ends on the question of worthiness. Mm-hmm. And then the story of Juan Diego opens with the question of worthiness, because when he steps into this flower world paradise, you know, as you know, he's not a warrior,
right,
spilling his blood, or a sacrificial woman, I mean, a victim, or a noble or elite, the people who are usually designated to be able to be worthy to enter the flower world paradise. That could explain why the first words of his mouth, out of his mouth, when he comes into this place, he says, am I worthy of what I hear? That's
right.
The first thing he says, you know, which I'll should ask you, why is he associating this flower world paradise with worthiness unless he knew about the whole kind of concept of who's going to be worthy? So, but he does enter into the flower of paradise. And why?
In real time.
Because not only is he a baptized Christian, but because he's walking 14 miles to Mass that morning, we must assume that he's, number one, devout, and mm-hmm. he's probably in a state of grace in order to receive communion. And we think just that point alone would have had a huge influence on the Nahua, because they always wanted to go to this flower world paradise.
Right.
And most of the commoners would never go. So and in a way, the Franciscans were trying to explain this unsuccessfully, this concept of heaven and worthiness and grace and how it all tied in together. But just in that quick little phrase, which usually gets glossed over by people, it suddenly he was there into this place. So, you know, it would have been unblocked to them. That's just one point. We can continue on.
And just a quick little tidbit on that. You could only go to this place after dying.
Right. So yeah, exactly.
So the fact that Juan Diego is going there as a live human being and comes back, there's an implication of a resurrection occurring, and that would have been translated to the Nahua mind as well.
Oh, yeah, and God,
gosh, I could keep going.
We could even go into this whole thing because, you know, the story of the ancient singer is in the realm of myth, okay?
Yeah.
But with Juan Diego, this is a real person. He's from Cuautitlán. I mean, we know a lot about him. We have testimonies of his personality and even that he was a landowner and that he married his wife, and then they were both baptized, and then she had just died 2 years early. I mean, we know this. We have it on a date. So what is happening here is that the myth becomes fact,
right,
which is the title of the paper by C.S. Lewis.
Right.
True myth.
But so much of that falls into this, and it becomes true myth. So as we explain in our book, the connection to the Flower of Paradise as life after death in a potential place that you would go to would have been the first, what we call the bridge of understanding that occurred there. And we still have plenty more to go on.
Yeah.
That's actually line 8, 9, and 10 in the account.
Right, in the beginning. It's
so
got like 200
we've already, lines, so. We've already have a, you know, a significant thing going on here.
So my wife and I, for a patron only thing we did, we've been doing, like, we've been reading fairy tales together, and And so she takes the female lines and I'll take the male lines and then we'll talk about it. And that we've been wanting to do more of that, but it turned into a bigger project than we thought. So we've done a few. But we did also the Nikon, I don't remember how you pronounce it. I call it the Nikon Mopohua, but I think that might be wrong. So we did it. Okay. So we did that one. And the translation wasn't great. I liked your translation better in your book. But when we got to that part, you know, is this the Flower World Paradise? In my head, it was kind of just a passing thought. I'm like, oh, I wonder what that means. You know, it's kind of, you know, it seems to have some sort of indication of they might be familiar with this or something. Like, so, but I didn't think that hard about it. I just think that's really funny that actually that was a whole big, it's a whole, there's like a whole cultural backstory spanning thousands of years behind that simple phrase. And I just, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And so you have Juan Diego and he meets the lady, right? He meets the lady on the top of the hill. I've always wondered why Tepeyac, why that particular hill? Do you know why that would be the case? Would be that specific spot?
We can only speculate, but we just have to bring up a potential wrench, a monkey wrench. It was known at that time to have been a place where there was a goddess that was worshipped.
Okay.
Don't know the name of that goddess.
Right.
So
I heard that, yeah.
Yeah. Because of that, many of the Franciscans thought it was a demonic invention.
Ah, that's okay. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So yeah. The Franciscans, there are a few of them who are skeptical. Yeah. There's a few of them, yeah. Like Father Sagahun or something. Like, I think that's his name. Yeah. He was skeptical.
Yeah, he was profoundly skeptical. Whereas there were other Franciscans that weren't skeptical, and the Dominicans whole hog were fine with it.
Yeah.
And then if you take in the context of Preparatio Evangelica or God preparing people for the gospel, you could take it easily, like, you know, the issue of Osiris and Isis. Many of them look at that as a prefigurement for the Egyptian people to then eventually accept Jesus and Mary.
Right.
They're considered figures. So in the same way, you could look at it like maybe this was God's way of preparing the pagans for an eventual coming of Our Lady of Guadalupe in this particular instance. So
yeah.
There's just different ways to look at it. But if we accept that God is in control of history, and that everything is under his dominion, regardless of how it's interpreted, then you just see a straight through line. So long as the people come all the way into Christianity and embrace all the tenets of that, the sacraments, the commandments, everything else, then there shouldn't be an issue. And Catholic doctrine has stated that to be true.
Right. So, and I don't think there's an issue with it being associated with a pagan goddess cult of some kind. I think that actually makes a lot of sense. Because of exactly what you said, the perpetual evangelica of evangelica. I don't think that's right. Mother Evangelica. That's not it either. You know, where they have this intuition that there's something special about this hill, you know, or another way to view it too is a sort of spiritual warfare too, where Mary's like, no, I am the true mother, right? And this is not, this is an imposter, and I want to have my shrine here to cleanse this hill of, you know, all the demonic practices or whatever, you know? So there's a couple different ways to look at it. And I think they both can work together, too. So, but I have heard that. I'm glad, to hear that is not just, an idle theory I heard. So another way that I thought was really interesting is how Our Lady incorporates the flowers onto the tilma. So why don't you talk about that and how that relates to the Axis Mundi?
Well, you know, as we're going back to that ancient song poem, it's essentially the singers looking for ultimate truth. So what we find is, you know, we haven't gotten into so many. I'll just kind of quickly. Okay, so first
yeah,
of all,
go ahead, please.
Juan Diego, we know that Juan Diego comes into the Flower World Paradise. Okay, this could be seen as what we call prefigurement. Essentially, because the description of the Flower World Paradise is so similar to not only this one ancient song poem, but what we see throughout the genre of flower song poems, it acts as prophecy, because something that was shown and described earlier on is now connecting to this story that actually happens in history.
Mm-hmm.
So it works in a way where God, especially in Catholic doctrine, the definition of prophecy is any means by which God speaks to humanity to draw them to himself.
Right.
So what we could see, if you're seeing this playing out, you're saying, wow, this has to be the hand of God, because these are things that we knew hundreds of years ago, and they're being played out, much like the way the Old Testament and the prophets of them pointed to a Messiah in a weird way. That's the way that God speaks to people to get their attention, especially. So we got that. Quickly, when Guadalupe introduces herself, she uses different terms, but one of the ones that's so important is that she says, I am the mother of the God of far and near in Tlokanawake. Now, if we go back to our earlier song poem, the way that it ends is that only the God of far and near in Tlokanawake can make you worthy to enter the flower of paradise. So if we connect those two concepts together, she is actually saying, I am the mother of the God of far and near, the one who makes you worthy to enter the flower of paradise. So that is a connection between their concept of a one supreme God, which they did have. As you stated, that hungry coyote, Nezahualcoyotl, was the first to come to that. And of course, many of his subjects would also share that. So that ancient concept of a one supreme God now connects to the one supreme Christian God. And that's a very, very important bridge that needed to come about. So now by the time we get to the flowers are seen as the truth of the universe, but also you only find the flowers in the flower world paradise. So symbolically and metaphorically, Juan Diego, since he found the flowers, he also gets to enter in the flower world paradise. And of course, if we extend that thought line, he only did it because he was a baptized Christian and because he was in a state of grace. So he's providing a pattern, a story pattern of reality for the Nahua, which basically says, if you want to enter the flower world paradise, you must follow Juan Diego's pattern. So that's the beauty of story. That's the beauty of myth. Because you can enter into that story like you could enter into the story of Osiris or Dionysus or Orpheus, and you could put yourself as that character, right? That's kind of what happens. And binging on Netflix or going seeing these Marvel movies or something. That's escape. That's what happens. But with the story of Jesus Christ, you can enter into that story, but you could actually live that story.
Right.
You can live Christianity. In fact, that's what actually the invitation is. So by him finding the truth of the universe, he's inviting the Nahua people to enter into the story of Jesus Christ and the saving aspect of his sacrifice. So that's why we say the millions were crying and begging and giving up their wives and ill-gained wealth and blah, 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 and all this other stuff in order to, because they craved it so much.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, there's other aspects to the story, but that's what we believe the Nahua would have seen this story and why they craved baptism afterwards.
And why 9 to 10 million converted in less than 10 years. That explains
it. Right.
Yeah.
It's this massive cultural epiphany that they had. Another concept that I really thought was interesting about the Nahua people is their concept of change is bad. New things are bad, right? So if it's tradition, it's good, but if it's new, it's bad. So they view the Christians as something new, right? This is new. We don't want anything to do with this. We want to maintain our own traditions, you know, and what you're offering is us basically, we got to give up everything we have for something new, therefore false, right? And how did Our Lady of Guadalupe kind of turn that whole concept on its head?
Well, I think it was a simple, and just to kind of, for the listeners who aren't as familiar, their actual word for truth is Nelly, but the meaning of it is that it was rooted, and the implication is rooted in the tradition, it's rooted in their culture, right? So when Mary comes and identifies herself, the first words out of her mouth is she's saying, I'm the mother of the Christian God, but then she says, I'm the mother of, and she uses five Nahua terms that are very specific to their understanding of the one supreme God. And among those terms, she says, I am the mother of Ntlokanawake, the exact same god that's mentioned in the ancient song poem that can make them worthy of the flower world paradise. So from the get-go, she's identifying herself with the Nawa people and their traditions and cultures.
Right. Well, getting to the idea of rootedness, you know, I mean, you know, we have this concept too, you know, even in our faith, that we want to be rooted in the traditions of our Christian faith. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the Eucharist, we have the celebration of the Mass, and you know, it's actually, you know, we thought about that, that in a way it's a mercy, mm-hmm. you know, that we believe that God gives to people, is because the tradition means stability. Tradition means truth in a certain sense to us too. So it would only be right that the Nawa people would say, well, gosh, you know, this Christian concept of a Jesus, you know, this God supposedly who sacrificed for us. I mean, this is just far out. Our ancient ancestors never spoke like this to us before.
Right.
Therefore, how are we going to change our lives around for something? Wouldn't have God given us indications if the God is universal in our own traditions and in the way, and what we're saying in our book is, yeah, God actually did give these indications.
Right. Yeah.
So you can believe it. So it was a great mercy, we believe, that it was done in this way.
And by extension, just to kind of fast forward through the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe and Juan Diego, on the day when he actually gathers the mm-hmm. flowers in his tilma, one of the aspects that we don't often talk about, but every now and again, is one of the indicators of that you're going into the flower world paradise is that you follow the path of the sun,
mm-hmm.
meaning that you have to enter into the flower world paradise from an east to west direction. And on the last day, when he actually is trying to avoid her because his uncle gets fatally sick, he ends up trying to avoid her by going to the other side of the mountain range. Before, he was looking from a west to east direction every single time he talked to her. Mm-hmm. But on that day, quote unquote, he inadvertently puts himself in a position to follow that exact route, which we kind of see as, again, Corporatio Evangelica. Again, it's God showing to the people of Mesoamerica that, you know, he's respecting you know, their ancient tradition and cultures, and he's going to speak to them directly by having Juan Diego travel into this flower world paradise to get the flowers from the exact same direction.
Yeah, that has become my favorite part of that story now. The fact that it was inadvertent, that he's inadvertently followed the path of the sun, because it's just so, there's something kind of, I don't know if funny is the right word, but it's he's trying to avoid her. He's trying to, like, you know, because his uncle's sick and he wants to go get a priest. And he's like, well, I can't talk to Our Lady right now. I got to go this way. But that's the way that he should go anyway, you know. And so he inadvertently, like, lives out this myth without knowing it.
Yeah, it reminds me of a Kung Fu Panda. I think there's a line, you know, where the wise, his father, I think he's a duck or something.
Yeah, he's like a goose. Yeah.
The path that you try to avoid is the path that you follow. I can't remember the quote, but it's the same idea that the hero is, he's trying to avoid his fate, but actually he fulfills it by trying to avoid it.
Yeah, which is in Oedipus too. And, you know, it's this very strong story structure where it's like you're trying to avoid the fate that's coming to you, only to, by avoiding it, you fulfill it. And it's, I just think that's so cool. Like, I don't have anything else to say. It's just a really cool thing that he participates in this myth, right? In this mythic structure, he lives it out in real time, and he does bring the flowers to the princes, or to the prince of the church, right? Bishop Zumarraga. And on the tilma itself, and this is probably the best part, in my opinion, on the tilma itself, there's a flower right over Mary's womb, and it's, is it a, I can't remember if it's a quatrefoil. Is it a quatrefoil or is it a quincunx flower?
It's a four-petaled flower.
Four-petaled. Okay.
So quatrefoil,
which is the quincunx.
It's
I see. Okay. Yeah. Are they interchangeable? Are those two?
Sometimes.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Well, yes.
All four-petaled flowers are quincunxes, and quincunxes are a four-petaled flower in an unformed state.
I see. Okay. But yeah, she has this over her womb, which would indicate, you know, that what is in her womb is the Axis Mundi, right? So, and who's in her womb, right? It's Christ.
Right, because, you know, what we're seeing is a two-dimension, okay, a flat four-petaled flower. But mm-hmm. if you could try to imagine it as a three-dimensional model, you know, if it was laid on its side, you could actually see the vertical axis, which points to the flower of paradise, or to eternity, right. or ultimate truth, and all this stuff. So, but if you see it as a two-dimensional image on the tilma,
yeah.
try to imagine this vertical axis, which goes from the middle of the four-petaled flower, which is kind of like a wormhole to eternity, which, of course, in this case, the four-petaled flower leads to that which is in her womb, which is Jesus Christ.
Right.
So Jesus Christ is the flower of truth, the Alpha and Omega of all truth. He is the God man. So that's what that flower is actually showing. So when people see the tilma and they're praying in the chapel or in front of Guadalupe, they are looking at that four-petaled flower and into Jesus Christ and to ultimate truth and beauty.
Yeah.
And goodness.
Yeah. It's amazing. So how did we might be nearing the end here, but how did the story spread? So, you know, Juan Diego, he goes to Bishop Zumarraga, he shows him the tilma, and then after that, people start coming in droves. So how does that work? How did that go from showing the bishop to millions of converting?
Well, essentially, you know, there was a longstanding tradition. We talked about the flower song poems mm-hmm. and the song poem, tradition in general. But what happened is that these songs, there would have been one song that would have been composed by a wise man or Tlamatine man. And that song, kind of like a computer meme, it would have been replicated throughout. Mm-hmm. It would have gone from village to village where music school existed. And that one song would have been memorized. And then it would have spread to another village. So that's the way the news got out. That's the way they spread their traditions and their history and also their philosophy, because these flower song poems would have been performed in the public square. So it's been explained by different Nahua experts that it was like philosophizing in the open air. So what we would say is that on pretty good authority to say that per that tradition, the Guadalupe story itself, the encounter between Juan Diego and Guadalupe, that itself would have turned into a Guadalupe flower song, so to speak. And it would have been replicated and it would have spread hundreds, possibly thousands of miles. And we do include in the book that there is a priest. His name is Father Becerra Tanco. And he actually saw that song performed.
Wow.
And also when you had these various accounts that were collected, that were written down of the Guadalupe narrative, they testified that they heard it as part of the oral tradition. So that is how that story would have spread.
Well, yeah, that's pretty amazing. I had a thought. I don't remember what it was now. Oh, well. It's just such an amazing story, and that this was largely not, I mean, it wasn't known. This just wasn't known. With the Franciscan missionaries, they had no idea. Even after the Guadalupe event occurred, I don't think they quite understood how that all happened. I mean, they had, you know, with the spreading of the songs through villages, they had an idea of like maybe the logistics of how that spread, but maybe not like the deep symbolism of the story itself and of the tilma. Even now we're still discovering the scientific craziness of the tilma, and how it's just defies every expectation. You know what you would, it's amazing. And so this book that you guys have written, I think is a, just getting, you know, it's a huge achievement. And it's shown me, because I was probably would have agreed with the Franciscans, you know, like, oh, they were barbaric people and all that stuff. But no, they're actually very sophisticated, very philosophically based, you know, very high. It was a high culture. You know, they had the very sophisticated culture. And I think I knew that to an extent, but I didn't know how deep their culture was and how rich it was in philosophy. So yeah, this book really, it paints a very good it puts everything in a nice cultural context while also drawing out those mythical elements in the Guadalupe story. So I think you guys, this is the best book I've read in a long time, specifically on this, wow, on this subject of like pagan. I mean, it's a very niche topic, you know, of paganism pointing to Christ, but it's just in general a very good book. So I'm very grateful that you guys wrote it and that it's out there and you guys are going out and talking to people. And because I think it helps us. I guess I'll ask this as maybe two final questions. So how can we apply this story to evangelical efforts today? And then I have another question that's more specific to the show. But so I'll let you guys address that one.
Well, you know, just kind of in a really practical way, you know, I think that, you know, as we're both Hispanics here, you know, when you're constantly kind of the drumbeat that, you know, you're of Aztec lineage, you know, you're all bad and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's kind of been preached in certain corners of Christianity. You know, you begin to think, well, okay, we're irredeemable.
Fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. And what I think with our story and what we're bringing out is that, you know, God went to a lot of trouble to try to reach these Aztec people and the Nahua people of Mesoamerica. And that God even wanted to redeem the Aztecs.
Yeah.
So if God went through all that trouble for the Aztecs, then why not a prisoner on death row?
Right.
You know, why not, you know, a homeless person. Why not anybody else? God is trying to reach out to you. He wants to redeem you. He wants to bring you to himself. So that's one idea. And I know Monique has other ideas too.
Well, you just on a universal application, we keep going back to God is in control of history. So what does that mean? You know, is that if God's going to spend a few thousand years to prepare these irredeemable Aztecs on the other side of the world, then that kind of shows us like a bigger view of kind of where we're at right now. I mean, we're looking at the news every day and it's just something new is blowing up, right? Just to kind of hang on to that hope that there's a resolution that's coming. We could pray for that resolution, wing it, hang tight. But kind of getting back to what Joseph said too, just the whole idea that when we're feeling the intensity of wanting to attack different groups or different individuals or one another, to kind of let go of that, because that is the temptation,
right?
Is to want to do that. You know, even they are not irredeemable.
Right.
Even the people who we consider the most against Catholicism and Christianity right now, they're not the real enemy. It's a spiritual enemy.
Right.
He's trying to take us all out. So, you know, we just kind of keep that focus and using Juan Diego, as we consider him like a perfect model, you know, of sanctity, as far as like, if we can follow the way he routed, the way the Nahua people followed his example, we can too. And it's much more minute and it's much more detailed, but the level of commitment and perseverance and hope is that mainstay that keeps our folks and keeps us from becoming bitter or cynical, which a lot of us are falling into. So that's kind of like the universal application.
Yeah, no, I agree. Nicely put. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I have one more question for you guys. This has been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot because I had all these lingering questions too in my mind about the book. And so this show, I ask this of every guest, and this show is called I Might Believe in Fairies, because I am personally, you know, agnostic as to whether or not fairies exist, right? But I have talked about fairies and other things like that, other like giants and dragons and other things. So I'm going to ask you, Joseph and Monique Gonzalez, do you believe in fairies?
Well, you know, if you classify that with dragons, I got to tell you, St. George and the Dragon, and I know we just celebrated the feast day. That has been such, well, it's one of my favorite stories of all time. And I would say I often refer back to that story to gain some courage, you know, to go out, to wake up in the morning and conquer those dragons, you know, to make that phone call that I don't want to make,
you know, to pay
those taxes you know, just so many things that you have to do here, you know, on Earth. So those dragons are very real to me, because they do influence my behavior. And it does mean a lot to me. So fairies, I haven't thought about much. But I will say it is real that reality is is some sort of a pattern that we must follow. I would say, okay, sure, I believe it. I believe in dragons.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Monique, what do you have to say?
Okay, short version. I actually have thought about this a lot.
Oh, okay.
Just because, I've always been into mythology and fairy tales, so I appreciate you so very much for that respect, in that respect. And for the longest time, I just figured, oh, it's just the realm of imagination. It's a metaphor. But sometimes I wonder, at least more recently, I believe that a lot of what we put in the realm of mythology, maybe, I'm not saying it is, may be a reflection of something that did exist at one point in time. Because if we believe in demons, mm-hmm. and we believe in angels and other entities, who's to say that they don't maybe take a physical form at some point?
Right.
And maybe they did at one time. So, I'm open to it as far as what they actually look like or what their purpose was. I have no idea. But I'm open to the idea. I think because of that, I know the spiritual realm is real.
Yeah.
So,
that's fantastic. Yeah.
Sure.
I know. I always ask that of every guest, and everybody gives me different answers. Some people are like, nope, I don't. And other people are like, oh, definitely, yeah. It's always fun to ask that question to people. And I think I agree with that, like with the legends and mythology. Like it's, especially when one is widespread throughout different cultures, like the vampire, like a blood-sucking vampire type creature, it's probably based in something, right? Right. I don't know what it could be. Yeah. So or giants, some trolls, so it's based in something. I'm open to, I like to be open to, I think it's more fun to be open to those things, as a possibility. But, thank you. This is great. Do you guys have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
This has been great. Thank you so much for we're able to get into different realms that we haven't in other interviews. So, which we love. We love this stuff. And thank you for reading it. Thanks for having us on. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But I guess the last parting thought is, and we use this at the very end of the book, what is our ultimate goal? Is to live in eternity with our Creator. So whatever it's going to take, let's go for it. And let's have the courage that God's going to give us the grace to get there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.